May 6, 1993, with the legend of Tejano music, José María de León Hernández.
Hijo eso.
Mira, el día que hablamos, I didn't have a chance to ask you a really important question. I went to give a lecture at the University of Texas last week, and I was talking about La Onda Chicana.
Oh, I asked him if I could sit in.
Oh, yeah, of course.
If you don't mind.
No.
One of the things that we never talked about, two things that I really wanted to touch bases with you on, is how you came to choose the name of La Familia, and the other one was your involvement in the Chicano movement and how this affected your approach to your music. Can we start with what brought about the change from Latin airs to La Familia?
Well, the fact that I was born and raised in Temple, Texas, where everything pretty much and was, still is, pretty much black and white. And then in the late 60s, hanging around the Bay Area, playing all around San Francisco and all around there, and becoming aware of Latinismo. And that was during the days, or late 60s, early 70s, when Santana was just taking off, and so many other groups from the Bay Area.
Right.
I just became aware of really Latinismo, la cultura and our heritage, our music, through Luis Gasca, the trumpet player, jazz trumpet player. I met a lot of his friends and worked a lot of concerts. He booked me in, and with groups from all over the country, and a lot of jazz groups, salsa groups from New York, and I just became aware of speaking Spanish was hip, you know, that was the thing happening, and I knew I needed to make a change from Latin airs to something closer to home, something closer to roots, and both my brother Johnny and I searched for a name. We came up with all kinds, but then La Familia just really stuck.
Can you remember some of the other names that you tossed around?
Yeah, we talked about Los Hermanos Hernandez, and we talked about different names that would occur to us, but La Familia just really.
What was
it
about La Familia that appealed to you?
One, the fact that I've been working around with my family, or my family had been involved in my business and the music and the record business and all. And Johnny and Rocky were in the band, and but it went deeper than that. I recognize the fact that Latinos from all over the world were one big family, and I thought that was appropriate to call the group La Familia. But La Familia, as I've always stated, it's not just the group, it goes beyond that.
It's like a symbolic name.
It's that, plus anybody that comes around just becomes family, you know. It's just it has a family atmosphere, so we thought that name was suitable.
Was the fact, this would be in 1970, right around that time?
That's when I changed the name over,
right.
Yeah.
Was the fact that the Chicano movement was going strong at that time, did that have any influence on you?
The Chicano movement, La Raza Unida and all that, was not really at that time part of that, but during that time also in the early 70s, Luis Gasca and Jim Castle made me aware of Cesar Chavez and the farm workers movement, and got me involved in doing concerts, and I met Cesar, and there was one part of it, and then La Raza Unida movement happened as well, you know.
Did you become involved in that?
Very much so, con José Gutierrez.
Can you tell me some of the things? I think, didn't you go to Mexico as an ambassador once, sort of a musical ambassador?
Yes, I did, with a delegation of representatives aquí de los Estados Unidos, and I remember reading the, and hearing the news in Mexico, llegaron los líderes chicanos a Mexico. And we met con Presidente López, was president at the time. And I was very much involved with, supporting the La Causa. And it again, you know, more so I just reaffirm my commitment to Musica Chicana,
right.
That we have something of our own, you know, and I didn't want to dilute it. And no matter what kinds of music I do play, I know we have our own, and that movement just made me reaffirm that.
I noticed that in some of the albums, some of those landmark albums like Para La Gente, it's like Ramon was saying earlier, that a lot of people, they wanted to hear what you had to say, like in between the music, like, "Órale, raza, here's my brown soul."
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been, to you, that must have had some significance. I mean,
well, you know, I do things out of feeling when I feel them, and that's how I felt at the time, and I still do, you know, but I don't know what interest people took on that, but, you know, I did it. Some like it, some don't, I guess, I don't know, but I just do what I feel I should do.
Well, I must tell you that I was a musician, a local musician in Fresno at the time, and our drummer used to do, actually, the drummer and the trumpet player used to do Las Nubes. We stole your material, Joe.
Well, good, good.
That's
what it's for.
And when we played Las Nubes, he would always say that part that he said, "Órale, raza, here's my brown." So he would even stick that in, you know. And yeah. Of course, La Raza, you know, at that time would get all excited about that. It seemed like there was a cultural atmosphere at the time that...
Well, there was an awareness that had to be brought about, you know. And unfortunately, it's there again in the 90s, you know.
Unfortunately or fortunately?
The unawareness that it exists again, you know, it's happening again, you know. I would have liked for that movement and that awareness that came about during the 70s to continue now, but it seems like we need to wake up La Raza all over again, you know. And
let me interrupt you. Do you think your music, even though most of the time it wasn't overtly political, it was just music, that there was something about it that awakened in La Raza a certain feeling of pride?
I think, yeah, that happens still today, you know. There's a lot of Chicanos that take pride in everything that we do. I'm talking about we, La Raza, how we talk, how we dress, how we eat, how we do our music. And this is something that the younger generations don't, younger people don't really, aren't really aware of, you know. The way I see it today, you know, like, we just really need to wake up to reality in the situation that we're in. And I've explained this to you before, how I feel that there's no visibility for us, you know. And we need to take, we need a movement. We need to become, make this a movement, and music has always played a big part in making things happen. So,
right.
We can certainly use that atmosphere again. We need to bring that awareness about to La Raza, and music is a big part of any movement.
¿Qué te iba a decir? I might have asked you this a moment ago, and my mind is just going, I think, but did your involvement in the political movement, you know, like with Jose Angel, did that in some way influence your music? Was it direct or indirect, or how did...
No, I don't know. I guess I was born to do what I do, and probably the biggest influence in my music was the way I was brought up, you know, and my dad being the rebel that he was, but he was very aware of what was happening con la raza todo el tiempo, you know.
But listening to a recording, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, but definitely how the movement de la raza unida, it did have to have some effect on how I felt towards the music or the music that I did,
yeah.
You know.
I was going to say that in listening to your stuff from the 60s, I mean, it's there, the music is there, but in the 70s, there seems to be that extra spark in your music as if, how can I put it? I mean, sometimes you actually, as in little things like Here's My Brown Soul, or yeah. The inclusion of, I can't even explain it, Joe, but it seems to me that you breathe Chicanismo in your music in the 1970s.
Yeah, like I said, you know, there was a movement, there were many things that happened in the 70s that influenced our lives as Chicanos. One of the things, like a lot of the deaths that came to Chicanos under the police custody, you know, I have somewhere a list of some over a dozen Chicanos that died under custody. And one of the ones that really touched me was Jose Campos Torres.
Right.
And I even wrote that poem for him, Dios mío, Dios mío.
Yeah.
But sure, there was a, you know, the only way I could release some of this frustration was through music. So it touched my music, sure.
You know, you were probably the only one who dared include that sort of thing. I mean, Sonny never did anything like that, or Latin Breed, or any, or Agustin, none of them. How do you?
I think, yeah, dare is a good word, because I knew I was told over and over that I would hurt my career and all that stuff, you know, that I shouldn't involve politics with music. But as far as the other artists, I don't think with them it was a matter of daring. I think it's just unawareness, you know. They just weren't aware of what was happening, you know.
They weren't as politically sensitive as you were, do you think?
I guess they just weren't, keep saying they were unaware and just weren't sympathetic to what was really happening, you know. Well, it happened, you know. But again, you know, I remember my dad always looking out after the less fortunate, the Los Chicanos, you know. So I just grew up feeling that way, like having to defend the less fortunate, the nuestra raza. But the other artists, I guess, it's just, it didn't mean anything to them, you know. They, and some were, you know, those that may have been aware was a little afraid or reluctant to get involved.
I happen to be looking at a painting on the wall. In that lecture that I gave at the University of Texas last week, I argued that that you changed in the early 70s, whether consciously or not. I argued that you changed because the cultural climate had changed, and you were sensitive to that cultural climate.
That's true.
And I argued that when you put out Para la Gente, even the album cover itself was evocative of our raza. Is that?
That's what. I had a young man do that for me, Fred Ochoa, who did that when he was a very young kid. He was 17 at the time, and unfortunately he died at the age of 20 from cancer. But he did a great job with that double-headed eagle, and that was to represent how I felt about la raza, you know, double culture, you know. That's what that represents. Un animal con dos cabezas, dos culturas, dos lenguas.
Excellent. So that's like a synthesis.
That's what that
of the two cultures.
Yeah, that's been my logo ever since. Yeah.
Do you realize that the music that you produced on that album? I know a lot of your music is like that, but that was probably the first album that you really put a synthesis of two musics together, where you have the ranchero and all of a sudden you have the American jazz.
Yeah, all blended together. Yeah.
Were you comfortable with that?
Pardon?
Were you comfortable doing that?
Oh yeah.
Music? Within the same musical piece?
Yeah, I still do that, and I continue to do that. I continue to experiment with doing accordion and steel guitar and the country western ranchero con with the norteño, all the, it all works, you know, if you can blend it together. And musically, you can blend so many things together. They can fit if you just have an insight as to how to make them come together.
Would I be wrong in saying that we Chicanos are particularly, como te digo, particularly open to this blending because we are, like you said, two-headed?
I think we are. I think we're very capable. The Chicano musician is so capable of doing all the styles and blending things together. Now, whether we want to or not, for whatever reasons, that's a different thing. But the most versatile groups are Chicano bands that I know of, and you know we take it lightly and don't think nothing about it. How many times we've seen a gabacho come up and say, "Yo soy su amigo," and get an applause from it, and we go between our languages back and forth, and nobody seems to care, or you know, it's just like nothing, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's an asset that's invaluable to us, and we really don't use it, you know. We still have to take advantage of our capacity for being bilingual and bicultural. Yeah. We're not doing it.
Do you ever talk that way? I once had an interview with Gibby Escobedo and Oscar Lawson, and if you listen to that interview, it's incredible the way empezamos a hablar español
back
and
always forth.
English y luego yeah. español.
Yeah.
You ever talk that way?
Most all the time, yeah. As a matter of fact, when my early trips to California, that was always the case that I go back and forth so much. Here lately, I guess I'm utilizing the English more than because I know I need to practice and learn it better. But when I get going, me atranco con un idioma y le entro al otro, and that was they always warned me cuando hacía las entrevistas and with especially con los todos eran mexicanos los locutores, you know, and they didn't want me to speak English or sing English, you know. So, but this has been the case todo el tiempo.
Yeah. I want to get something straight, porque when it comes to your story, I've talked to different people, and one of the most valuable was Tony Hamm, when he was playing with you. By the way, I found out today, I hope this is not classified information from someone, mm-hmm. that when they broke, and I'll get back to what I was starting to say, but let me get this out of the way first. When they broke from you, they tried to use the word, the name La Familia?
Yeah.
And you had to file a lawsuit against them and all
yeah,
that?
Yeah, they had to go to court for it. It didn't bother me, but it bothered my brother because we had already invested time and money in
the name
La Familia.
Well, yeah, it's like a trademark.
Yeah, and they wanted to, they thought that they could use it because they were the band, you know, and it was already cemented, Little Joe La Familia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they went to court and it was no contest.
Yeah. Well, too bad that things like that happen among musicians, but I guess...
I think that's a matter of expanding, you know. If musicians didn't leave different groups and start their own, you know, I mean, that's just how that goes. You know, all the great jazz musicians at one time or another played with other great jazz musicians, and they just evolved, you know. So, nosotros la raza tenemos que hacer lo mismo. Everybody should, I think, at one point or another.
Because the name change is so symbolically important for my study, from Latin Airs to La Familia, I want to make sure that I have all the facts around it correct. When I talked to him about this, here's what he told me, and then from your own recollection, tell me if that's about right or. He told me there came a point when we kind of reached a low spot, he said. And he said, we played somewhere in West Texas, Odessa somewhere, he says, and we got 50 people. And Joe said, you know what, man? We're going real fast. This is getting dated. Here we are wearing these goddamn James Brown suits. Those are his words. You know, everybody else is wearing, you know, something different. And that you had said, I'm going to disband the group for a while. I need to do some thinking on this. He said, pues se fue pa' temple. He said, I didn't see him for, I don't know, 4 or 5 months. He said, and then he called us together again. He said, cuando lo vi, I almost didn't recognize him. He said, he looked like a cross between a militant Chicano and a hippie, he said. Traía cadenas, he say, his hair down to his ass, y la chingada, y que ready to do. ¿Sabes qué? From here on, no more Latin airs. From here on, with Little Joey La Familia. And they said, that's how La Familia came to be. Is that more or less, as you remember
well,
it, or is there, is that
no,
wrong?
not really. What
okay.
happened was, what happened was, we were playing, we were doing a lot of the shows, like I was saying earlier, in around the Bay Area, and we had amassed all these good musicians, great musicians, and we were playing. I was working so hard for the band that pretty soon it was like I became a slave of the group, you know. And I always like to feature the musicians, and I think each individual that plays with me deserves the spotlight. I've always had good musicians. And what happened was that it got to the point to where they were running the band, and they thought it was that the hipper they made the music, that the better, you know. They were actually we're really getting away from what Little Joe and the Musica
Chicana,
La Familia, La Familia. They got so hot, you know.
But I think we were going back to before that, when you were still the Latinos.
Well, no, this happened when I disbanded. That's why that they thought they could pick up the name La Familia. That's what happened there. We were, like I said, we were staying around the Bay Area a lot, and then I, you know, I was booking the flights and even becoming their band boy. So.
But you were already La Familia then, right?
Yeah, it was already La Familia.
See, what I was talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, no, that's
forgive
not.
Forgive me, is that. There was a point at which you decided to change from Latinier to La Familia, and that's...
I wanted
to concentrate on that for a second.
Yeah, no, that change came about from being around, like I said earlier, around the Bay Area and all that. I had already changed the name when I disbanded.
I see.
And the reason for disbanding was, like I said, you know, we started playing these concerts, and we were playing with, like, you know, groups... the Bay Area and all, and we were trying to imitate and outplay them at the stuff they do, and we weren't reaching the people, you know. It mm-hmm. was obvious. I mean, you are what you are, you know. I'm not a salsero, you know.
Yeah, right.
And there's one particular concert that we were doing at Berklee Theater, Berklee is the Greek amphitheater. I let the band play, and I was even getting off the bandstand, letting the band, you know, excel. And they weren't moving the people, so I got back on and did what I do, and it just sparked off the thing. The amare comenzaron a bailar y a gritar y a aventar sombreros, you know, música chicana.
Yeah.
Yeah. And because that's what I'm about, and that's when I realized that, you know, the band kept thinking that the hipper they made the arrangements that, and it was just getting away from it.
Right.
And I just got tired and told him that I was going to disband, and Ham had already made plans to take the band over, you know, and that's what they did, but it didn't last, unfortunately, because the musicians were great, but
no, they had leadership.
No,
they needed you. You were the one that.
Well, you know, it's not just about music, you know. There's
yeah,
a lot.
Right.
It's something else. It's. Yeah. I don't know, it's something that people feel or like or want from an artist, you know, because I can easily make music very complicated if that's what we want to do, you know, but they found out the hard way that it wasn't the band all along, you know,
yeah.
the source was coming from somewhere else.
Yeah. I had a talk with Manny Guerra some months ago, and he called... Well, we were talking about the fact that the old orchestras, as you had it at one time, con todos los pitos and the
yeah.
whole works, were a thing of the past. And I said, what about Rubén Ramos? He said, no, he's really a dinosaur. I mean, the orchestra is dead. How would you look at, I mean, is he right?
Well,
as we knew it, with all the horns, he said, that's dead.
Well, for whom, you know, I guess it depends. But for the Chicano thing, yeah, there's always changes. It's like the conjunto was dead, and I started incorporating the accordion with the band, you know. And here again, the conjunto's back, you know. Some of these young groups, they call themselves bands or orchestras, when literally they're just conjuntos, you
right.
know, the accordion, what we call a conjunto de accordion, you know. But as far as orchestration, orchestras, you know what an orchestra is. It's with a string and, you know, an orchestra.
Yeah.
And we don't have orchestras. We have bands, you know, ensembles,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
And...
Well, in Espanol, it's an orquesta. La orquesta de Mike Cornell.
Yeah, yeah.
La orquesta
yeah,
de Ciro López.
Yeah.
La orquesta de Little Joe.
Actually, some bandas, you know. And bandas, los Mexico call bandas like school bands, you
right.
know. It's kind of
yeah.
marching bands. But... it just depends on what markets areas we're talking about. No, there's not a lot of horns in the bands today. There aren't any because it got synthesized, you know.
Yeah.
But Ruben plays good music. Is good music. I use horns in the band. You know, I have one horn, but electronically we're talking
yeah.
about
yeah.
you know more than one horn. So it just depends on what markets we're talking about. If we're talking about Tejano groups, yeah, they're not using the horns like they were before. One or two horns suffices, you know.
Yeah. Well, I guess on a local level, though, there are still bandas, orquestas, like,
yeah.
I guess Paul Elizondo,
Elizondo, yeah.
I guess those orquestas still exist, but they're only local. Are there?
Yeah, yeah.
Or Ricky Diaz in Houston. Or
There's a lot of bands locally, you know.
But they don't play the Tejano sound, right? They play...
No, not really.
Something else.
That's true. But, yeah, there's not like the big band era, you know. The Duke Ellington band continues, and the Harry James and all those people, you know. But Chicanos for what's happening now for La Onda, which is, again, you know, it's just a small market. The four or five horn sections are not happening. We just don't have the musicianship for one.
You think that's the case?
I don't know if that's the case, but I know that's one of the reasons, you know. It's like, who can really write or you know, arrange for it?
Well, some people tell me that it's a lot cheaper to carry a small group than to carry, say, a 10 people.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, anytime you have to move on the road with less people, of course, it's less.
Is that an incentive then to size down?
In most cases, I think it's just the fact that we just don't have the musicianship and that ability to write and orchestrate and arrange for more than one or two horns.
Mm.
That ability is not there with the younger musicians, unfortunately.
Just a point of information, in the 1970s, when you recorded with strings, were they the real thing or were they synthesized?
No, I used the real thing, yeah. Yeah, I used the real strings because at the time the synthesizers weren't happening yet.
So like in Para La Gente, the strings that we hear, where did you get the strings?
From the Dallas Symphony.
Dallas Symphony?
Yeah. Yeah, the strings on the 25th Silver Anniversary, which was recorded in 1985 in San Antonio, that's 30 strings from the San Antonio Symphony, yeah.
I don't think I've heard that one. I'd like to listen to it sometime.
Yeah, it's... Bob Gallarza arranged that for me, and we did use the strings from the San Antonio Symphony.
I had put together, of course, when I'm looking for things, I can't find them. So, as a kind of as a wrap up here, I know you need to leave.
No, you came a long ways, man.
We've talked before, but my main point was to get your views on the politics of the 1970s, your participation in that, and how that...
You see that picture there? I guess you saw that.
Which?
This one right here. La Marcha Esa.
¿Esta de aquí?
Y el pueblo chicano y los mexicanos unidos.
Que vive el pueblo chicano mexicano. Are you in there somewhere?
No.
Oh.
No, I'm not. That's María Elena and José Ángel, but those are the marches that were happening at the time.
I see.
I'm not in that particular picture, but I was... Those are the kind of things that I participated in.
Yeah, yeah. I like this one right here. But it's
as a matter of fact, you're going to have pictures in your book.
Yeah, but por eso estoy aquí, because...
That would make a good...
Which one, this one?
No, no, de la marcha.
Oh, yeah, but I just want pictures of the orquestas. I mean,
oh, yeah.
The book is not obviously political.
Well, that's true.
Political, but I understand, or it seemed to me that especially in your case, you were certainly influenced to one extent or another by the whole Chicano movement. I mean,
Yeah, well, you know, I've always felt pride for who and where I come from, what I am, you know. But that was there, like I said, due to my dad, you know, and then Porfirio, my brother, he was always so proud of the family, you know. And when I was a little kid, I remember him talking about La Familia, you know, being... La Familia Hernandez being who we are, and he was very aware of that. And then later on, of course, you know, with the movement, that just reinforced my pride, you know. It's not an ego or a false pride. I mean, everybody should be proud of who and what they are, you know. And we, La Raza, just need to really polish our pride. We just need to, you know, to be assertive, to be aggressive, to be, you know, aware of who we are.
Me acordé porque you met Cesar Chavez.
Yeah.
See if you recognize anybody.
¿Cómo se llama el mariachi?
Oh, el mariachi de la tierra. It was a local group. It was a good group, so it was an excellent group, actually. An excellent group.
I think we did something in Stockton together. We did something in Fresno. I saw you 2-3 times in different areas when you were playing trumpet. Te vi así vestido de mariachi. I remember that.
When I first heard this, I really didn't pay any attention to Tejano music for a while. Mm-hmm. But I remember driving in my car one, it was a hot afternoon, 1973, I guess. And this band was playing, man. Yo chinga, le abría el radio y dije, God damn. I didn't know if Tejano could do this sort of thing. Era las nubes.
Yeah.
I mean, it knocked me out of my socks, you know, when I heard that thing. I went down to the record shop and got the album. Le dije, Beto, ¿sabes qué? We got to play this, man. We got to play this song. I'll write the arrangement for you. So I copied the arrangement off the record because I was a music majorist.
Yeah.
And we played the hell out of that song. And then later we put in Que Culpa Tengo and all those songs. You know.
Well, you know,
you were a tremendous influence on us, Joe. God damn.
That's just how I felt about music, you know. Like I've said before, you know, I'm fortunate to come from the times and era that I did, you know, because I grew up listening to big bands, you know, that kind of music.
That's what I wanted to ask you. I want to have the intro to Colección Olvida. When you first got your first record, Safari, me dijo Ramón que it was part one and part two.
Yeah.
Were you trying to crack the top 40 with that or what?
No, we just wanted to record.
Well, why didn't you record una pieza tejana mexicana?
Because I started playing, when I first started playing guitar, I started playing like standards, you know, High the Moon, Over the Rainbow, Stardust, The Misty, Hot Toddy, all those old things, you know. And then when we decided to record, it was the rock and roll days, you know, that was 1958. So we put together an instrumental. I wasn't doing much singing at the time, and we wrote that thing, Safari Part 1, Part 2, and amazing, it's a hot tune, man. If it were out today, it would sound like, you know, like
it was. You know, I've never heard it, Joe. Do you have a copy of it somewhere?
I don't, but Sino Moreno has.
So it's
Tony Matamoros?
I'd give anything to hear that. I'd give anything to hear that tune, man.
What I was thinking, like, for the movie soundtrack, you should re-record that.
What, re-record it?
Yeah.
it's possible. I, you know, but that's why we're playing all, you know, Beto Villa's music and Valde Gonzalez's music.
Right.
But when we recorded something original, and that's what we came up with.
But didn't you? I mean, even after 1958, when you kept recording, didn't you, at some point in time, say, I wish I could crack the top 40 like Sonny had done?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean,
they
course.
All wanted to do that.
Yeah, yeah. That was everybody's dream, you know,
to
get on the Dick Clark show and, yeah, they get on the charts. It just didn't happen for us. We really weren't writing that much towards that, you know. We were doing a lot of remakes. And we thought that was hip because that's what Sonny had made it with, you know.
Yeah.
In Sonny's case, though, the song was a hit, unfortunately, not Sonny, because he was never to come up with another, you know.
Yeah.
And in some cases, it's the artist, you know. He hits, it doesn't matter what he sings,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
But Talk to Me had already been done by Little Willie John.
Really?
Yeah, that was.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was a hit, and then Sonny redid it. He recorded it.
Was there a point in your career, say early in the 60s or sometime in the 60s, that you decided to cast your fate in Tejano music or chart your course within Tejano music as opposed to the top 40?
somehow the Tejano thing was with me throughout all the time, you know. Different musicians in the band influenced me different ways, but I always came back to the Tejano thing, because I could be very original and do very much what I wanted to with that kind of music.
Yeah.
The rock and roll and the country western, you know, I wrote some songs and stuff. That was the intention when we recorded Ramona and Little Girl of My Dreams, you know, for that market. But the Chicano thing, it was something that was there and just continued to evolve and it's something that I could always experiment with, and it was just so easy for me to be original, you know. I was never a hot guitar player or a good musician, so it was a lot more difficult for me to copy anything or anybody. It was a lot easier for me to just do things my way.
But you had a very distinctive voice that really caught on. You and Johnny sounded great together. I'd love to hear you guys sing together again.
That's just something that's a God's gift, man, because sometimes I even feel bad because people wouldn't imitate me, but because
they couldn't.
Well, so many singers get imitated so easily, so quickly, you know. Salió un Agustín, chingo de Agustín, es un Isidro López, chingo de Isidro López. And I kept, you know, some people would take it as an insult. I would take it as a compliment if I could find people to imitate me. The only band and vocals that I ever heard that sounded like me, hollered like me, and sometimes even confused me, is David Perez, who now lives in California. They're out of Plainview. David Perez is orquesta, he and his sons, and they sounded so much like Little Joe and the Latineers, but they're the only ones. But you know, through the years, there were so many that could sound like Sonny, that could sound like everybody else, and I always thought, well, why the hell don't they sound like me and Johnny, you know?
They couldn't. I don't have, Ramon is hopefully going to give me a discography of your music, but after Safari, did you have to wait long before you cut some more records?
We did Safari under the name David Coronado and the Latineers. And then the next recording would be Little Joe and the Latineers.
And when was that?
I was thinking it was 1960, but I may be wrong. It might have been 62. We need to definitely look into that.
Was it a 45 or was it an album?
No, I recorded, I went to San Antonio and recorded two singles or four songs. Four sides, and I recorded El Corrido del West y Ciruelito.
That's your dad?
Yeah, my dad wrote those. And then I recorded A Little Girl in My Dreams and Ramona, which man, my brother wrote. So when I started recording on the Little Joe and the Latineers, I recorded four songs, two English and two Spanish. That's how I kicked off really my career. Yeah, I don't know.
But Bobby Butler was on the other one, he's fine.
Okay, well that came after, but the first ones I recorded would have been. Yeah, I did six or eight songs for Rankin. Was it Rankin? Yeah.
When was the first LP recorded?
1964, and that was Por Un Amor.
Por Un Amor.
That
was your
album.
First big hit, wasn't it?
Actually,
the biggest to that point, is that correct?
Well, yeah, that continues to grow today, you know. It's just something that just people love that song, and from the...
But was that a sort of turning point for the band?
Por Un Amor, yeah, although we were hot already with Corrido del West and those songs that I have recorded in Angel, but you know what, we did Por Un Amor...
Valmon,
yeah.
¿Cómo se llama la compañía?
Valmon, V-A-L-M-O-N, Valmon Records. And then we went to Sarape and re-recorded it on Sarape Records. But Por Un Amor was a very, the bigger hit that started playing outside of Texas. And
yeah, we heard it in California in the 60s.
Yeah.
That's where I really began to hear about you.
Yeah, that would have been.
I was already there by that time.
The very early 60s, yeah.
Which one of those albums was it that you recorded the first version of Las Nubes in 3/4 time and waltz time?
That was on Sarape.
What year would that have been, Ramon? Do you remember?
I've got it to this.
It's amazing the transformation of that song from that little, you know, really folk song to Las Nubes in the 70s to...
We were living in San Jose, California at the time. We stayed there for about 3 months, I guess. I just wanted to use strings. I love strings, you know. I wanted to use violins, and I needed the right song for them, you know. I just have an inner feeling for music that whether I can't read or write music, but I can hear these things, you know. Johnny and I searched in our minds and trying to find the right song to use strings. I just wanted to use strings on Tejano music. And finally, after researching Las Nubes, I thought, we'll do this in polka time.
Was that a Nubes, I've never been able to trace that song. Is it a folk song or does it have a composer?
There's a composer out of Matamoros named Juan Hernandez. And Juan Hernandez was in a band, a conjunto, and they were recording an album, and they needed one more song, so they took a break, and this guy went and wrote it and came back.
Juan Hernandez. Compuso las nubes así de volar?
Yeah, and he came back.
How do you know about that?
I spoke to him. I was in Houston doing an interview, and we're talking about, it seems like no matter what interviews I do on radio, Las Nubes pops up, and we're talking about that, and I got a phone call, and it was Juan Hernandez who had written it and gave me told me the little story.
Well, you know why? Because un amigo mío, he's an historian, he's a professor at Berkeley, tells me that Las Nubes became, he's doing a history of todo el movimiento, Las Nubes became like a national Chicano anthem.
I hear that and hear lots of times. I know that record went to a lot of schools, universities, colleges. Porfirio, it was Top, my brother Antonio, who was in charge of the company at the time. We mailed it off to lots of schools that they wanted it for Chicano studies.
What do you think made that song an anthem? What is it about it, in your opinion?
It had been recorded by Paulino Bernal and myself in 3-4 time, you know. But I think what really turned it over was the arrangement, the orchestration. Now that's orchestra. And the feeling that it was recorded with, and we did something. We just did something unique that hadn't happened by using the string section the way we did. And the overall feeling for it, it's almost spiritual, you know. It just reaches people, and it's not about language. Plus, the message, the words, when I was at the march and the funeral for Cesar Chavez.
Did you go to that?
Oh, yeah, sure.
My
sure.
Goodness. Well, finish out the thing about Las Nubes and everything.
Well, one of the things they asked me, one of the guys there, the news media, they asked me if something came to mind about writing for Cesar while we were there in the procession. And dice, ¿alguna canción viene a mente? You write something about it? And I thought, yeah, I might write about it, but what comes to mind immediately is Las Nubes, and that's what he was waiting for me to say, you know. It's the words, the lyrics are just really haunting. It's, ya todo se me acabó. Si voy a seguir sufriendo, yo mejor quisiera morir. It's deep.
Yeah, well, I think it certainly does capture one side of our culture. You know, the resignation, the sorrow, but there's
the struggle.
Side, yeah, the struggle, right.
And you know, like, just the other day, in San Antonio, the Campanas de America, Juan Ortiz, he was so excited. Hey, Joe, I was just driving by and I heard the San Antonio, the Army, 5th Army Band, the marching band, they're playing Las Nubes.
So it was, wow.
Yeah, in schools, that song, that arrangement gets played in schools and Army bands.
Well, when I first heard that song, it knocked me out of my sock, can you tell that? So you went to the Chavez funeral, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I would have missed it. No matter what, I would have canceled it. I would have had to been really ill not to go to something like that.
That was a shock. You know, for those of us raised during the Chicano period, the Chicano movement, I mean, I played for this guy a lot. Yeah. I mean, it was so... It brought so many memories just thinking about, you know, all the things that we did.
I had a nice, warm picture of Cesar and I.
Oh, yeah.
And that farm worker banner was given to me when they marched through here and marched with them un rato aquí, and then I played a fundraiser for them here in Temple while they stopped here. But that was in Fresno at the freeze when they had that.
Well, that's when I interviewed you the last time. Interview.
Yeah, that's true.
Friday. Yeah.
But you know, losing Cesar was not just a great leader and somebody that brought dignity to the workers, farm workers, and you unionized them and all that. But I felt a real close relationship with him. It was something really personal, you know, because every time I got around him, you know, I just felt that it re-energized myself, you know. There was a peace and calmness about him that I really enjoyed being around Cesar. And, you know, it just fortified me. It's like, I can keep going if this guy can, you know. Yeah. And he just inspired me, you know. And
where is it going?
It's getting harder to define what Tejano is.
You're right.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, it's... again, the music has gotten so simple, you know, it's been simplified to the point to where it's gone to doing what the Mexican acts have been doing all these years, you know, and the stuff that they call cumbias, which are not cumbias. Cumbias are Carmen Rivero Colombianos, you know.
Right.
But the Mexican cumbias are playing such an important or an intricate part in what Tejano is today, you know, that I don't know where it's headed, I just continue to do what I've always done, you know. I don't know if it's called Tejano Tex-Mex or some mixture of the music that comes from the Southwest, but I don't know where us border rats are taking música Tejana today. It's like I say, I think it's getting real difficult to define. It's lost a lot
right.
of. It's lost a lot of its identity.
A lot of the biggest groups today, it seems to me, strayed pretty far from the Tejano music, like Selena and La
sure.
Mafia and Maz and those people.
Yeah.
What would you say is the core feel for la música Tejana, la canción ranchera en polka tempo?
That was it.
El polka beat.
Right, the driving energy
yeah.
beat, you know. And... It's like rock, like any other high energy music, but that's not where it's at today. It's boom boom boom, ding ding ding. That cumbia thing that they call cumbia, which is really not
very very slow. They play it real slow.
Yeah.
Real slow.
And but you know, everything is a cycle, and I can foresee where that'll wear out as well. You know, more so because you can't tell one group from the other. You know, it's so.
Yeah.
So similar, but I think it'll recycle itself and it'll come back to where people they'll hear the refreshing sound, which will be the old sound with horns, and
maybe we'll have another movimiento, you know, and then
we certainly need one. And
La Onda Chicana will come back alive to life again with another movement. Maybe that's what we need.
Well, we need the movement for sure, and. It's just hard to replace brass and reeds, you know, for making music. We can do it synthetically, but it's not the same. And I think musicians will grow weary of tired of the same sound, and they'll get back to it. I think everything recycles, and I think música Tejana Chicana, like we know it, will come back.
One technical question, I guess, is of sorts. I remember very distinctly that in the 1970s, what it was essentially Tejano music in your person and some of the other groups around here came actually to be known as La Onda Chicana.
Yeah.
How did it acquire that label, and when did that label disappear? Because I don't think it's called that anymore.
No. When I was started playing it, I always called it Chicano music because that's what I am and that's what I called it. And then we started calling it Tex-Mex as well, and then La Onda, and then it went to La Onda Tejana, and which today is just Tejano.
Yeah, but there was a while when it was actually called La Onda Chicana.
Well, yeah.
Not Tejana, but La Onda,
La Onda Chicana, yeah, yeah. And I think La Onda Chicana was probably Johnny Gonzalez, was pretty much one of the persons that
coined that term,
yeah.
Johnny Gonzalez.
Sarape Records.
He was the president owner of Sarape Records. He had a TV program on Channel 11 called Fiesta Mexicana from 1966 to 1984. And, you know, from the start, he started with La Onda Chicana. That was his, like, his gimmick, you know.
Yeah, the
I remember it really caught on in the 70s. I mean,
yeah.
And they were really talking about your music and, you know, and like, Freddy Martinez and all that. That was
right.
La Onda Chicana.
Exactly.
Which is really an orquesta sound.
Yeah.
Porque el conjunto no le decían La Onda Chicana.
Right.
They just called it conjunto.
Yeah.
It was your orchestral sound that was called La Onda Chicana.
La Onda Chicana, yeah. And you know what? I don't know what your time frame's like, but if you were to visit Con Gonzalez, you did, didn't you? I think he would be real good to have a lot of good information for the book. And he can tell you a lot about during that time, because he was a big developer of this music, you know.
Where was that, Johnny?
In Dallas.
Oh, in Dallas.
Ramon just visited with him, and he could give you some real good information for your book, because after all the input he had for La Onda Chicana, then he went Mexican, started doing a lot of Mexican shows, concerts, and you know, and he was really one of the big founders for the music for that, I think, that you're researching.
But it's no longer called that, obviously. You don't hear that La Onda Chicana anymore.
No, it's called Tejano now.
Tejano music.
Yeah, Tejano.
Tejano 106, Tejano this, Tejano.
Yeah.
Tejano. Which collapses all kinds of music into one rubric, ¿verdad?
Yeah.
Now Tejano music is everybody. From Emilio Navaira to you to Maz to, although I don't know, Maz, sometimes they do stuff that's not really Tejano, ¿verdad?
Well, I think Mafia is the one that has really gone Mexican, and they're doing excellent, really well, you know, but
how about Selena? Are they doing Mexican more than anything else now, or are they still?
Yeah, they've gone to that. But it works. It works for them, you know. And then I can see where things have to change, and, you know, they have to branch out and expand. But the core of Musica Chicana is not what it was. It's not around anymore. And you're right, Ruben is a dinosaur. And there are other bands that aren't recognized, but there's, you get to New Mexico, that's where they're at, man. They don't want anything to do with what's called Tejano today, man.
Yeah. They want the old stuff.
Yeah, they want the
Latin. I think California is the same way. Because
the Latin airs is what, where they're at now.
Yeah.
And Mexico, their groups are finally getting there with the Latin air sound.
Yeah.
I just did did some interviews at different stations in California, low in Chicago, and they were playing some music that sounded like the Latiners, you know. So 25 years later,
they're finally catching up.
They're catching on. They're here.
Back in 1967, it was March 1967, Danny Gonzalez signed a distribution deal with CBS Records in Mexico. And, you know, a lot of the present Tejano companies, like when Hacienda first was distributed by RCA, Roland Garcia was making a big deal. First Tejanos to be distributed by a major American label. And then CBS came along, and we're the first to go to the Tejano market with a
Sarape.
Sarape, he was being distributed, and we had albums in Mexico.
In South America
Harmony,
as well.
Under the Harmony label, as of 67, that's how they got to know you. Johnny gave me all the newspaper clippings.
Yeah. We had some in South America. I don't know if
it's in the paper. I mean, it's not word of mouth. It's actually the black and white for Mexican newspapers.
You were being distributed down there. This was
in
19.
Yeah, by CBS under their subsidiary called Harmony Records.
Pero qué año fue?
67, more 67.
Boy. I've noticed like at Fiesta and all those places, there's a lot of these oldies featuring you and Sonny and a lot of people.
Yeah.
They're being distributed all over the place now. The Latinaires seem to be a real big thing.
Yeah, that's those are recordings from Sarape that were sold and sold, resold to other companies, and Papalote Records, and I don't know, Scorpion Records, all kinds
Does
of
Does that benefit you at all? Or
No.
You don't get derive any royalties
no,
from those
I'd be a rich man today, because that outsells any and everything. See, Handelman owns a lot of that stuff, so they're the big distribution company. They really
But do you still maintain any rights to this album? And
I own that one.
From the 1970s?
Yeah, I own everything on Buena Suerte, and that's one. Yeah.
So you still get some royalties from the sales of those?
Yeah, we just did this.
And that's... really re-enhanced, so it sounds better.
Yeah, and that's just the first batch, man. That's where the gold mine is, and I'm just beginning to mine it.
Well, there's a lot of nostalgia, you know. People like the Chicano generation, me, people like in our age, they really yearn for that old stuff. They want to.
Well, it just went out, and they ordered the first round. They ordered 18,000 copies because they thought that was going to do it, 6,000 of each, and they're ordered 52,000 now. And this is the first order. And the campaign on TV is just going to start on the 10th.
So these are, each one of these is individually being reissued, okay?
No, one more.
I'm sorry, I'm not quite.
The thing is, they're taking
three songs from each album.
From each album.
To come.
So this is one. This
that's
would be
15 songs. So
out of five albums.
Three from here, three from here, three
I see,
from
I
there.
See. And then they would be with three. And these are your own. I mean, this is your stuff.
Yeah, that's
so you derive some.
I own it all.
You're set for life, Joe.
Well,
even if you stop performing. Which reminds me, before I forget, how much longer can we expect the king of La Onda to kind of...
The way I feel today? I don't know. As long as I have the energy and I feel pretty good. I don't know how much longer I can keep up the pace, but who knows? I feel good.
Otro 20 años por lo menos.
That would be great, but you know, if I get another five, that's fine. Whatever I get, but I'm setting this company up for my kids, like I've told you before, and that's just the first batch going around. I have at least 30 of these masters to choose from. So, another thing is that we're doing is making sure that the people don't buy and rebuy the same cut, you know, because they've really burnt the public with that. Meanwhile, all my recordings have been shelved. So when they buy these, they're not going to buy the same song on a different tape.
Right.
We're making sure that they every time they buy a tape or a cassette, a CD.
So this is your company that's distributing?
Yeah.
Is that what it's called?
Well,
Tejano Discos?
Tejano Discos is our record company. And it's been distributed by Rodman.
Oh, yeah. Rodman is...
out of Venezuela.
Right. Yeah. They're pretty big, aren't they? I mean, they put out a lot of stuff. I've seen a lot of their stuff. In the Latino market.
Yeah, they're just now getting into Tejano, so they've made me their Tejano record company. I'll start producing artists for them, but we're real excited about what's happening here. Also, we have four videos. You need to show them what we have. But this is my second time around. First, it was Buena Suerte, and now it's Tejano Discos.
I like that other label. The name was nice.
Buena Suerte.
Why didn't you revive it? I mean,
I had to ride on this Tejano thing, which I prefer Tex-Mex to Tejano.
Yeah.
But if you notice, Tejano 107, Tejano Parse,
everything's
Tejano.
Now.
And I need to. But you see, I also emphasize the TD, Tejano Discos. It'll be TD. So. When Tejano plays out, it'll just go Touchdown Records or
right.
TV records.
Yeah, that's right. Bueno, Joe, I think that we have covered just about all the unanswered questions that I had, and I want to express my appreciation to you for putting up with me.
No, I
believe
told
me,
you.
This is all important to what I'm doing.
I enjoy your visiting anytime, whether it was for interview or for whatever, Manuel. I don't get to see you that often, but when I do, I always enjoy talking to you. Who wouldn't when they praise your work, huh? But it's not just you understand where this music comes from. You played a part in it as well, and I agree with you. It should not be overlooked or be undocumented, you know. And we do have a lot of people that are partial to it and they're just not getting it, you know. And I think that's probably one of the most important factors in my success with this record company. Bringing back out all the nostalgia from these old recordings that are people so eager to replenish in their catalogs.
Yeah, they do. I want you to know that you have somebody right here, Ramon, who's doing a lot of work.
Well, that's why he's here.
Yeah.
And
eventually, I think his stuff will come out as well.
As
we
a matter of fact, you might
angles.
Want some quotes from him for the book.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
We're coming from different angles, obviously, but all this work is important.
Yeah.
And again, you know, my... I'm going to express my appreciation.
Gracias a ti.